If you open your pew Bibles to page 713 with me, or whatever other Bible you prefer, I'd like to look at Mark chapter 7 together this morning. Mark chapter 7, verses 24 through 30. Illustrated right over my left shoulder, my right shoulder as you're looking up here, by that beautiful, I don't know what to call that. It reminds me of an engraving by, some 17th century person, but I bet you it's more recent than that. Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an evil spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek born in Syria and Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. "First, let the children eat all they want," he told her, "for it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Yes, Lord," she replied, "but even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And then he told her, "For such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." She went home and found that her child lying on the bed, and indeed the demon was gone. Now, if you're more familiar with this story than some of the others, you may think there's some pieces missing here. That's because you've also read the part in Matthew 15, where the same story is recounted in more detail. So if you want to, you can put your finger in that place and also sort of compare, because we're looking at both those accounts of the story. There's three personas in this story: Jesus, his disciples, and this woman of sort of unclear racial background, sort of ambiguous racial background. Oh, and then there's a fourth person who you never actually see until the very end, the demon-afflicted daughter, who's the reason behind all this. But she doesn't actually appear in the story hardly at all. And about half of the commentators that you read about this say that it's the disciples that are the focus. They say that Jesus told this story in order to teach a lesson to the disciples. And if the disciples sort of represent you and me, who are those who are being formed as a people, then I guess we need to look at their attitude and sort of learn a lesson from Jesus as they did. So who are they? Who are the disciples? What have their experience been like? Well, the last few days have been very, very busy. Very busy. If you look at the previous verses and chapters, you see that Jesus had been preaching and teaching for days on end, that he'd had crowds around him for days on end, to the point where people were really starting to get faint with hunger, and then he did one of those miracles where he produced lots and lots of food so they'd have enough strength to get home. Have you ever been in a crowd of thousands of people for days at a time? I don't mean taste of Chicago for a couple hours. I mean, really a long stretch. When we lived in Spain, we found ourselves one time at that famous running of the bulls in Pamplona. My wife was teaching a seminar, and we happened to be there during this time when Hemingway made the thing famous. So now there are like 60,000 people camped for 5 days in the streets of Pamplona, drinking beer 24/7, relieving themselves wherever they happen to be, standing around, and at 7 o'clock in the morning running with a bunch of angry, sober bulls. It's kind of an uneven match. And frankly, we were very glad to get out of that atmosphere after a couple days and go back to a nice, quiet little village that we lived in. It appears that Jesus understood that his disciples, too, needed to get away from this crowd. They just had kind of had enough. And so they went this long detour up the coast of the Mediterranean Sea up to Tyre, long ways away from the places where Jesus usually ministered. And apparently they hoped to find some quiet time for some R&R. I don't know what it was like for the disciples. I sort of imagine them standing around with their hands in their pockets saying, "I wonder where we can get a good bagel around here." And just sort of feeling kind of out of it, like an Israeli would in Lebanon today, almost the same situation, wondering how long Jesus wanted to stay here. But then before they can really get into enjoying the quiet, the cat gets out of the bag somehow, the news gets out, and this lady comes in and starts disturbing the rest. I mean, really disturbing it. She comes calling on Jesus, sort of blowing his cover, calling him Lord, son of David, as Matthew tells us, and sort of letting it out who he actually is. And when she comes into the room, bursting into the room with her emotional demands, it's an ill-timed interruption on the agenda for them, I think. They say to her, "Hey, listen, you want some ministry help? Some counseling, perhaps? Come back Tuesday. We're closed." And when she persists, they urge Jesus to take care of the problem because the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and she's very squeaky. And so they're saying to her, they're saying to Jesus, "You know, please take care of her. She's making a fuss. Would you, you know, kind of stop this?" Because they, like we, just want to take care of the demanding need so it's done with it. Often that's how we treat ministry. Let's just get this problem taken care of. Somebody's got a need. Okay. We'll take care of it, but, you know, as quickly as possible and get back to normal, peace and quiet. It's not clear from the syntax whether they're asking Jesus to just send her away without meeting her need, or whether they're saying, "Hurry up, do one of your miracles," so we can, you know, so she'll just leave us alone. Now, it seems like it's more of the latter to me. It seems like that. Just give her what she wants, will you, Jesus? Just... I want to watch the surf roll in off the Mediterranean. Take care of her. Make her be quiet. They're not really interested in her welfare. They're not really interested in seeing Jesus' glory manifest. They just don't want to have to keep dealing with this problem anymore. Does that sound familiar? Do you ever feel like that? I do. And disciples are worn out by this lady's clamoring. They just say, "Make her shut up." There's not a lot of real love being shown there at this point. Now, if I'm partially right in interpreting the story, then let's see, what's the problem? Who is this woman? Well, Matthew says she's a Canaanite. Now, that's a harsh word for most of us. It's the only time you ever see that word in the New Testament. Most of us thought the Canaanites had disappeared. Well, they had. When Joshua came in, crossed the Jordan River, and the sea people, who you and I know as the Philistines, they came in from the other side. They squeezed Canaan or Palestine like a tube of toothpaste, and the Canaanites who were left went north. They went up and became the Phoenician race. So that's why Mark refers to her as a Phoenician. He kind of stumbles around. Our translation here doesn't really show it, but Mark says she was a Greek. Well, Assyrian. Well, Phoenician. He just doesn't quite know what to call her. And that's kind of interesting. You know, these two authors both are sort of stumbling around. They don't know quite what to call this woman. They know she's not Jewish. But what is she? And I think they, as well as we, feel a little uncomfortable sometimes with ambiguity when it comes to racial matters. If somebody has very clear Asian features, oh yeah, okay, fine. If they very clearly have African ancestry, yeah, that's okay. But what if there's just something in between? I mean, if there's some sort of mixture, we often feel just a little bit uneasy, unless it's Tiger Woods or, you know, somebody like that, Hal Berry, you know. Otherwise, we're just sort of ambivalent sometimes. And if you're one of those people yourself, you see it in people's faces. They look at you and they just keep looking, trying to figure out, who are you anyway? And sometimes that's just uncomfortable for people. When I worked next door at the Wheaton Chinese Lions Church as the English pastor over there, and we were getting ready to leave, one of the first candidates who they were bringing in was a guy who was like sort of like that. You'd look at him and you weren't quite sure what his background was. And he was used to a lifetime of people looking at him that way. He knew what people were thinking. And he was candidating to be a pastor of a Chinese church. So he let people know right away his background. He said, "My grandfather was Chinese." "Ah, okay, good, nice. And my other grandfather was of African descent." "Oh." "And my one grandmother was East Indian." "Mm-hmm." "And my other grandmother was half Caucasian and half Chinese." And you can see the little internal calculators whirring away as people are trying to figure out percentages there and trying to see what's going on. And they just, not too comfortable with somebody. The guy had a PhD from Oxford. He had 20 years of experience in the ministry, but there was just something sort of, they couldn't quite put their finger on it there. What do we do with that? Well, our text shows that that's an issue here. It's an issue here. Even Jesus appears like he's going to play the race card at some point in this story. Our text itself, the fact that these writers can't just say, "And a woman came to him," The fact that they're sort of struggling to identify who she is there some way that we can sort of justify this ministry on the part of Jesus? One time some Jewish friends brought this centurion to Jesus. And the way Luke tells the story, they said, he loves our nation. He loves our nation. I mean, he may not be Jewish, but he built us a synagogue. And so the New Testament often shows that. And the same thing with the guy up in Caesarea, the other centurion who Peter went to visit. You know, the Bible's very clear to tell us that he gave alms to the people of God. So there's always this sort of this justification that if he's not really one of us, but he's still sort of, you know. it's amazing how uncomfortable we are with that kind of ambiguity. But there's more about this woman. It's just not clear what her role is in society, but she's got another problem, a big problem. It's her daughter. Her daughter's acting up. Her daughter's deep in the dark side. Her daughter's doing things. Her daughter's getting a reputation. Her daughter is making herself known all over the community for being different and being evil and having evil influence. And this woman's embarrassed and she's afflicted and she's got to deal with it at home all the time. And what is she going to do with this problem? She's tried everything she can think of. And now she hears that Jesus is nearby. And that's her only hope. So she goes to see him. Now, what about Jesus? What was he thinking about? What was he looking for at that moment? What kind of mood was he in? What was he planning to do that afternoon when she showed up? Well, I think Jesus was beat. It doesn't say in the text he was tired, but if you go back and look in the previous verses just before this, you're looking back in chapter 6, the pace of Jesus' public ministry had become almost hysterical. People were just, I mean, let me read Mark 6. He'd spent 3 days teaching and healing. People had stayed there overnight. He fed 4,000 people and finally dismissed them all, got into a boat, hoped things would be quiet, came to the other side of the lake, and it says in verse 53 of chapter 6, when they'd crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret and moored to the shore. And when they got out of the boat, immediately the people recognized him and ran about the whole neighborhood, began to bring sick people in their palace to any place where they heard he was. Wherever he came, villages, city, countryside, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and begged him that he might touch even the fringe of his garment, and as many as touched it were made well. And chapter 7 says, when the Pharisees gathered together to him, some of the scribes who'd come from Jerusalem, they saw some of his disciples ate with their hands defiled. They began to criticize him. And that's a pattern over and over in the Gospels, as I'm sure you're familiar with it. Jesus is constantly surrounded by dirty, smelly, loud, demanding crowds. It's always like a near riot wherever he is. And then as he meets people's needs and things finally quiet down and people carry off their sick, or people go running off who used to be sick or paralyzed, and the crowd starts to thin out, and finally you see out on the edges the critics. It's always that way. You get done with all this ministry, and out there on the edges, there's these religious critics standing there saying, Jesus, you know, a lot of these people are eating with unwashed hands. Sounds almost like your worst case mother scenario, isn't it? You know, not, wow, you healed over 400 people today. How did you do that? How did you connect in with God and get all that power? That's not what they're saying. They're saying, you know, some of these people who gratefully follow you around haven't learned all the kosher principles yet. What are you going to do about it? You ever think Jesus just kind of wanted to grow a beard and put on reflective sunglasses and maybe a big floppy hat and disappear? Well, he already had the beard. I guess he'd have to shave it off to become incognito. Do you think Jesus ever wanted to get away from it all? I was reading an interview with Keanu Reeves in the newspaper a couple weeks ago. Maybe you saw it too, in Chicago Tribune. And the interviewer was asking Keanu if his fame ever caused problems. And Keanu answered very annoyed, yeah. People I've never seen before recognize me and say hi. Whew. Don't you just feel sorrow for this guy? To put up with that kind of a burden for only $42 million a year. I don't know how he puts up with it. Jesus had to put up with a whole lot more than people coming up to him and saying hi. all day long he was dealing with desperate, needy people. People for whom whatever their case was a worst case scenario. It was the biggest crisis they'd ever faced in their life. It was the one thing that was keeping them from fulfillment and contentment and happiness in life. And Jesus was just dealing with it constantly. For them, it was one worst case scenario in a lifetime. For him, it was five or six of those a day. Maybe five or six dozen of those a day. Can you imagine? Day after day after day, every moment of your life, constantly dealing with everybody else's most difficult, most impossible crisis. And he was in the flesh. I mean, he's divine, but he was living in the flesh. I've been teaching a course recently in critical thinking at the University of Phoenix, and one of the things we deal with there is problem solving. And one of the solutions, one of the ways to do problem solving is to imagine impossible scenarios. Here's one, an impossible scenario. Did Jesus ever get tired of ministering to people? Jesus? No. That's impossible. Well, read your scriptures again. I think there's plenty of evidence that Jesus got pretty tired of listening to people whine. He got tired of people's stupidity, particularly that of his disciples with their constant incomprehension. He got tired of explaining and refuting his theological opponents. Maybe he even got tired of ministering to people. In any case, at this particular moment, after this particularly grueling series of weeks of ministry, he's off hoping to find a retreat. He's off the map. You know, Tyre and Sidon is a long ways off the beaten trail of his ministry in Galilee and Judah. And he's up there. It says in Mark, he settled into a house. He did not want anyone to know he was there. My wife and family and I, we lived in Cote d'Ivoire for two terms, missionary terms, almost 10 years. And often went on vacation to this place called San Pedro. It's almost mythic proportions when you hear Cote d'Ivoire missionaries talk about San Pedro. This vacation house for missionaries cost about $6 a night. And it's a two-bedroom apartment with a kitchen and a balcony looking out over the ocean. And ocean's out there 30 miles this way, 30 miles that way. You can see forever. And, you know, the water is just perfect. And we'd go there on vacations and just enjoy it so much. First couple times we went there, by mistake, we went down to the local Alliance Church on Sunday. It just seemed like the natural thing to do. You know, we drove into town, found the African church there. Oh, man, of course the pastor wanted me to preach because he saw I was probably a missionary. And then he wanted me to come back Tuesday and Thursday and drive him around in my Toyota and visit his parishioners out in the woods. And pretty soon we learned when you come to San Pedro on vacation, don't go to church. If you want to be on vacation, don't go down to the local church. Do something else. Sounds cynical, doesn't it? I wonder if Jesus ever felt like that. You know, I think maybe I'll just, let's just do synagogue here today, guys. What do you say? You know, if we go to the synagogue, there's bound to be all these people come crowding in there and demanding from me. Anyway, despite all his attempts at anonymity, here he is, and here comes this lady. And she just won't let go. She won't let go of this need she has. And Jesus' first response, according to Matthew, is just to ignore her. Just ignore her. Just act as if she doesn't even exist. Ralph Ellison's 1952 novel, The Invisible Man, poignantly shows what it feels like to be a person that others just look right through you. You know, Ralph Ellison was Afro-American, and in the early 50s, late 40s, a lot of people who were white just looked right through black people. They weren't necessarily afraid of them or dislike them or hate them. They just didn't even acknowledge their existence. And he wrote about that. It's an incredible feeling. Maybe you've experienced it too if you're one of those folks who's sort of of an ambiguous appearance and others look at you and not sure what they are, so they just look away and don't look at you too close because they don't know what to do with that. I think this woman had been dealing with that from the Jews for quite a while. She's probably used to it. You can tell by her interactions with Jesus, she knows kind of what her place is socially. And she's used to it, and she's not even resentful about it, apparently. But his disciples, they're riled up because she just persists. She won't let go. Give him something. Give her something. Jesus, just send her away, would you? And then according to Matthew, Jesus says, I was just sent to the lost sheep of Israel. Now, that sentence and the one that's following, the next thing that comes out of his mouth, which is in both Mark and Matthew, are probably two of the most difficult sentences in the whole New Testament. always say to John when he asked me to preach, thanks, I really appreciate the opportunity. I notice you're leaving on the week that we would deal with these difficult verses. Because Jesus says some things that are difficult to say there. And if you read the commentaries, you'll come up with dozens of different explanations for these really difficult sayings of Jesus. In some cases, people say, well, he was just testing his disciples. Or he was just testing the lady's faith. And other people say, no, he really did intend to sort of leave. He wanted to stay within the confines of the ministry his Heavenly Father had given him, that is, just in covenant Israel. But he just couldn't help it. He had to minister to the Gentiles out of pity. Sort of as if Jesus would show up before his Father's throne and say, sorry, Abba, I know I wasn't supposed to minister to the Gentiles, but if you could just see them up close, the poor, cute little things, they're having such a tough time. I'm sorry, I couldn't help it. Sort of like a kid who brings home a grungy adopted puppy and, you know, can't we keep him? Oh, speaking of puppies, you notice the next thing he says? I think, you know, if it's difficult to understand Jesus saying, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel, this next thing that he says is really tough, isn't it? It's not good to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. Down through the centuries, I doubt if there's ever been a sentence that came from Jesus' lips that's been more difficult to understand than that one. What did he mean? It sounds so harsh, doesn't it? Our time is short, so I'm not going to go into all the possibilities, but I'll say this one thing to you. I noticed this week, and I never noticed this before, but this is the diminutive form of the word dog, the diminutive. If your name is Robert, people may call you Bob or Bobby. If your name is James, they may call you Jimmy. If you're from down south, it'll be like, you know, Bobby Jim or Jimmy Bob or anyway. The diminutive is an affectionate way of saying something, and that's the term he uses here. So it's like he's saying the little doggies or the pooches or all the affectionate little terms he used for the family dog. Some of you think, I don't care, he called her a dog. I don't care, he called her a dog. If you've ever watched a dog who's really part of the family, I think that changes the image. I mean, he's talking here. I mean, have you ever seen that food that you so carefully and lovingly prepared for your children slide into their hand and surreptitiously go under the table and surreptitiously be released for the doggy who's so beloved? I think that's more the image. At least it could be what Jesus is saying. It's not the right thing to pass it on like that. I worked hard. This is for you. This is for the children. And they're passing it on. And yet she catches the glimmer in his eye. She catches the tone in his voice, which of course we can't get here. But I think she understands what even his disciples didn't understand and says to him what he understands so well. Even the little poochies get what comes from the children, the crumbs. Even they get some hand-me-downs. Even they get part of it. And she's so humble. She's saying, I don't care what you call me. Just meet my need. And she comes to Jesus with that sweet persistence that he loves and honors and rewards. And he says to her, okay, you can have what you want. And she goes home and there it is. Now, what's this have to do with you or me? Well, depends on who you relate to. If you're relating to the disciples, if you're relating to Jesus, if you're relating to the lady, if you're relating to the kid who's hoping mom will come back with a solution. But the one thing that I hope that we all go out of here is the fact that Jesus allowed this woman to prevail upon him when he was off duty. I wonder if we're ready to do that. Are we ready to minister to people when we're off duty? There are certain moments when we say, yeah, I'm available for ministry. I've put that in my calendar. I've penciled in 10 o'clock Tuesday mornings. I'm doing ministry. What if somebody comes up to you at, 10:45? Not on the calendar. Does Jesus want us to minister when we're not in office hours? Well, he did it. I think he wants us to. And I ask you one last question, and then we'll take communion together. Do you think Jesus, after this, was able to go back to resting? Do you think he was able to enjoy the retreat after it had been so violently interrupted? Well, I think the answer is he probably enjoyed it more. Back in Israel, his ministries were constantly criticized and analyzed, and the religious elite were divided over whether he was even legitimate or not in his ministries. And here in foreign territory, the persisting faith of a woman who was outside Jesus' normal racial boundaries, she persisted, and I think that sparked encouragement in him, as it will in you if you allow yourself to be prevailed upon. If you allow yourself to meet the need that someone presents to you, someone who may be way outside the margins of what you usually think are your homies and the normal range of people to whom you relate and minister and serve, if somebody from outside that and from outside of your time schedule comes and asks you to serve and you do, I think you'll come away encouraged, thrilled, animated. Let's pray. Father, if the call comes today from a needy person, I pray that you'll give us the strength to answer that call as coming from you. In Jesus' name, amen.